model prayer given us by Christ, and then we have gone back to Abraham and then kind of work our way down through biblical history by looking at the prayers of God's people. And tonight we're like 100 years down through history, farther than we were last week. And the nature of the prayers that we are considering tonight is almost 180 degrees different in terms of purpose and occasion and setting than those two were last week. Remember, we studied the prayers of two of the great kings for help and for deliverance, the prayer of Jehoshaphat and the prayer of Hezekiah. And now, and those were both in settings of the assembled people of God, and they both brought wonderful answers that were obvious and out in the open, and you couldn't miss the victories that you couldn't miss. But now then, we're looking at the prayers of one servant of God who had a hard task and whose prayers were only answered with the strength to face the task. And this is a different setting. And unless we think that prayer is sort of the ideal spiritual experience something you do when you are feeling most like you're supposed to feel, and when you're engaged in the most obvious spiritual or religious activity, glimpses of exercises like Jeremiah's are to be considered and reflected upon. And I've titled the Confessions of a Lonely Prophet. But I think that the feelings that are here and the emotions and the prayers that are here fit other kinds of servants of God too. Service to the Lord is, whether it's by a parent raising a child, whether it's by a Christian wife trying to navigate the demands that are placed on home and family now, whether it's a Christian worker on the job, or whether it's a Christian young person in a school setting, or an elder in the Lord's church, or teachers, or what. There are ways in which these passages fit. And I found in one of my introductions to books of the Bible, this part of a larger paragraph or sentence about Jeremiah that caught my attention. This writer points out that the circumstances and the temperament of the man made Jeremiah, and this is the part I want for us to have in our hearts here, who the prophet who lays bare before us the intimate dealings of his own soul with God. There may be some of you here who have engaged in the discipline of writing your own private prayers down from time to time. And most of us, if we have done that, would probably, if we've been honest as we were writing those prayers, probably not going to show them to anybody. That's our personal things. But here's Jeremiah, a man who is as frank as you can be, whose prayers are before us, all of us, in order for us to be able to consider them and learn from them. There are some things about Jeremiah's prayers that I think make them unique, and I even found one writer who describes them as having unique psychological aspects. He's talking about any passages in the prophets. And there are two reasons for that that I've jotted down for myself here. One of them is you don't read through Jeremiah and say, all right, now here are the passages that describe his prayers. Number one, number two, number three. There are prayers that are in the middle of it all. And there are prayers that are recorded not because he set out to describe his prayers, but because this is how a man who is engaged in this kind of work expresses himself to God. This is how a man who has a task that is in behalf of people but's not appreciated by the people, who has a responsibility from God but he doesn't see how God is helping him in the middle of it, this is how that fellow expresses himself to God. And the other thing is, and consider for a minute what I'm saying here. This is a prophet who is told three times that I can find, maybe there are other times, but I could find these, where he's told not to pray for his people. So if you think about this, here's a God who sends a man to speak for the Lord to his people, and a man who cares obviously urgently about his people, he ends up staying with them, being carried off into exile. A lot of people think he's the man who in Hebrews 11 and verse 37, who was stoned. Now think of it, by faith some were stoned or sawn asunder. And a lot of people think at Toppenes and in Egypt when he's carried down there. This is a guy who says, don't depend on the Egyptians, surrender to the Babylonians. And then he has to stay with his people and be carried off to Egypt. And what would it be like to be told not to pray for this people, but to have all of your life invested in this people? And that's the strange thing about this. Now, I think it'd be hard for me to try to do this, maybe for you too, without spending more of our class doing it than I want to take for it. But we need to at least be a little bit aware of the circumstances that are going to give birth to the prayers that we'll read tonight. And here's a simple way of understanding it. There's an evolving geopolitical balance. That's a big way of saying Judah is caught right in the middle of a power struggle in the world at the time. When we were studying last week, the Assyrians were the dominant world power. But the Assyrians begin to decline, and the Babylonians begin to ascend, and the Babylonians conquer the Assyrians in 612 B.C., right in the middle of the time when Jeremiah is at work among his people. And if you consider what happens, it is Judah being tempted now to act like it is powerful enough to be on its own. The Assyrians being defeated, the Babylonians exercising their cruelty and trying to spread their influence, the Egyptians trying to seize the moment to assert their power and their influence, and in the middle of all of that, Jeremiah gets sent to speak to the people of Judah about what they must do. There is an aborted religious revival. Aborted is my term here, because Josiah becomes king in Judah, what, about 627, something like that, B.C. Josiah follows Manasseh, long reign, and Amon, short reign. Can anyone tell me what kind of characters Manasseh and Amon were? Horrible is an understatement. You read the passages in Jeremiah where the people were going to Topheth, or the Valley of Hinnom, as it's also called, the background for the New Testament word Gehenna, and they were burning their sons and daughters to Molech, an idol. Descendants of David, Judean kings doing that. And in comes Josiah as a boy, and he begins to lead a religious revival. The book of the law gets found in the temple. They start reading it. They start tearing down what shouldn't be there. They start rebuilding. They reinstitute the priesthood and the sacrifices and all of that kind of thing. But then Josiah confronts what a lot of religious revivals confront. It's easier to establish the form of it than it is to put spiritual substance within that form. And then Josiah went out to fight Pharaoh Necho at a place called Megiddo. And he got thrashed and he got killed. And the religious revival suffered the consequences of that. And then there's weak, wavering civil leadership. Josiah's son Shalom, also known as Jehoahaz, becomes king and lasts a few months. He gets removed by the Egyptians, and his brother, Jehoiakim, who gets put into power, and he lasts a little while, and the Babylonians come and carry him off. He's also known as he's followed then by a brother named Jeconiah. See, Jeconiah comes after Shalom. He gets carried off, and then Jehoiakim. I may have those two reversed in order, but he doesn't last long, and he gets deposed, and a man named Zedekiah gets placed in power by the Babylonians. But he's always caught in between, wanting, they want to listen to Jeremiah, they don't want to listen to Jeremiah. They want to listen to, and part of the reason is because there are very vocal prophets whom God didn't send. They're saying, peace, peace in Judah, when there, what? There is no peace. Jeremiah is telling the people, you've already broken the covenant. You've ignored every opportunity to amend your ways. The only way for you to survive, the Babylonians are going to seize this city. If you go out to them, you will live. If you don't go out to them, you're going to die. And the false prophets are saying, there's a third option. Let's ally with the Egyptians, and we can live without submitting to the Babylonians. Now, ultimately, as you know, it didn't work, but it made Jeremiah awfully unpopular. Because God sent Jeremiah. He takes the man, remember Jeremiah chapter 1, oh Lord Jehovah, I'm but a child. I don't know how to speak. And God says, I'll be with you. And he sends him. And the people understood Jeremiah as a traitor. They understood him approving of having to surrender to the Babylonians while it was breaking his heart. And all of that's going on in the background of the prayers that we're going to be thinking of tonight. And I can't imagine anyone having a harder job than what Jeremiah had. He had to preach an unpopular message which broke his own heart to people who did not want to hear it and who regarded it as being the work of a traitor to their cause, while he was being persecuted by those who were lying to his people. And that's the situation. Here is the temperament. You know Jeremiah as the weeping prophet, probably. You've heard that, him described that way. I don't believe his temperament can be thought of as being morose or depressed. This is a courageous, strong, undefeatable man who does what God sends him to do in a very difficult situation. But his temperament is fashioned somewhat by his ability to identify with God and with his people. And you can see this in several passages. I've chosen a couple here. In chapter 8, there's the, if you notice 8:21, it's the, For the wound of the daughter of my people is my heart wounded. It turns out, you can see the Lord is speaking in this situation, and Jeremiah's identifying with him. I want to read you a familiar passage here, 8:22. Is there no balm in Gilead? Gilead, one of the higher places in the land. Is there no physician there? Why then has the health of the daughter of my people not been restored? The daughter of my people may represent Jerusalem, or may represent the whole people. And then listen to this. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. Oh, that I had a desert place, a traveler's lodging place, that I might leave my people and go away from them. For they're all adulterers, a company of treacherous men. They bend their tongue like a bow. Falsehood and not truth has grown strong in the land, for they proceed from evil to evil, and they do not know me, declares the Lord. So I read this, and I first think these are the words of Jeremiah, but when I think about this, this is the Lord. Jeremiah identifies with him, because you find Jeremiah with his eyes weeping like this as you go on through this book. Now look over in chapter 14, by the way, in 14:17, Jeremiah's eyes running down with tears like that is described. In chapter 14, Judah is now mourning in Jeremiah's vision the consequences of her own sin. And in chapter 14, verse 2, you can see that. And they're trying to acknowledge their wrongdoing. I'll say it that way. And look at the way the prayer is phrased by Jeremiah in verses 7 and following. Though our iniquities testify against us, act, O Lord, for your name's sake, for our backslidings are many. We've sinned against you. O you hope of Israel, its Savior in time of trouble, why should you be like a stranger in the land, like a traveler who turns aside to tarry for a night? Why should you be like a man confused, like a mighty warrior who cannot save? Yet you, O Lord, are in the midst of us, and we're called by your name. Do not leave us. That all sounds perfectly penitent, doesn't it? But you have to remember, they say this in response to the prophet's message, the Lord has already decided that you're going to be taken away captive, and the way of life is for you to go out and surrender to the Babylonians. This is this is what they say after they've been told that. This supposed repentance is itself a rejection of the message of the prophet. That's and the a man's heart who's torn A man who cares, he's torn in these two different directions, identifying with God and his people, is sort of what you see here. Now, the bulk of our class, I want to involve in this part of it. And with a lot of this, and I hope you won't mind, I'm going to ask you just to read the prayers. Read them from the perspective of the man of God who prayed them. And a couple of them, I'll take a little more time, and we'll try to set the situation and describe it a little bit. But look in chapter 11 to start with, and I'm going to just put up here a phrase that describes each one of these prayers. And the first one, Jeremiah thinks of himself like a lamb who's led to the slaughter. I think there's some shadows of Isaiah 53 in this, but what happens is the whole first part of chapter 11 explains what's going to happen in Judah in terms of God simply upholding his covenant. His people are going to deal with the curses of the covenant, chapter 11 and verses 2 and 3, because they have broken God's covenant, and they have brought all the words of the covenant upon themselves. And he wants to know what right they have to show up in his house, in his beloved house, having done these vile deeds and so forth, and over again willfully. But what happens is, Jeremiah's telling his people this is not met with, "Oh, we didn't realize what was going on, we're sorry." Instead is, "You can't say that to us." that kind of thing. So Jeremiah's prayer in verses 18 and following is this: "The Lord made it known to me, and I know, and I knew, then you showed me their deeds." And this would also mean his judgment on the deeds. "But I was like a gentle lamb led to the slaughter. I did not know it was against me. They devised schemes saying, 'Let us destroy the tree with its fruit.'" The tree is the prophet, and its fruit is his words. "Let us cut him off from the land of the living." What's another way of saying that? "Let's kill this guy, that his name be remembered no more. But, O Lord of hosts, who judges righteously, who tests the heart and the mind." You'll notice that idea in Jeremiah's work repeatedly. "And then let me see your vengeance upon them, for to you I have committed my cause." That last phrase we'll run across again in reading about this. So what is Jeremiah asking there? What's he praying for? What's he confessing? He's confessing that he feels like a helpless lamb in the face of vicious predators. He's confessing that he knows that they are plotting against him to destroy him, and what he wants is for God to search his heart and for the God he's committed his cause to deal with him and them justly. Is it Christian to pray like that? Have you ever prayed like that? You have to care about a cause to pray like that, and you have to have committed yourself to God's keeping to pray like that. You have to also realize that one of the ways a person who cares processes things is to be able to turn it over to God and to ask for God to be the God of justice in that situation. This happens in Jeremiah quite a bit, and it fits with the whole circumstance. Jeremiah, if anything, is a guy who sees the unavoidable connection between iniquity and its harvest. I mean, that's old, and this is simply recognizing that in prayer. God reassures him in verses 21 through 23, and then a second part of this prayer cycle comes in chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. And look at the main phrase in it, the one I have up here. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? The flip side of this prayer is, why do the innocent suffer? Sometimes why do bad things happen to good people? This is the, in some ways, an even more troubling part of it. Why does the person who engages in wickedness seem to be planted by God and blessed and made prosperous and fruitful and nothing happened to him? Jim. Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah, I agree that there's similarities with Job and probably with Habakkuk also here. We bear in mind that it's hard enough just when we're living and we have bad things happen to us and we wonder, but when the bad things happen to us because we are serving the Lord and doing what He said, it's even more difficult here. So notice chapter 12, verse 1 beginning. Righteous are you, O Lord, when I complain to you. How was Jeremiah complaining to God? In prayer. Yet I would plead my case before you. And see, God has said, in the previous verses, at the end of chapter 11, he's going to help Jeremiah, but he's going to punish these people. But Jeremiah says, why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why do all who are treacherous thrive? This is like Psalm 73 also. You plant them and they take root. They grow and they produce fruit. You are near in their mouth and far from their heart. But you, O Lord, know me. You see me and test my heart toward you. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and set them apart for the day of slaughter. How long will the land mourn? Now, why is the land mourning? Because of these people. Because of what they're doing. And how long will the grass of every field wither? For the evil of those who dwell in it, the beasts and the birds are swept away. The whole land is suffering because of the evil of these people. Why don't you deal with them instead of letting the whole land suffer? That's what he's asking. And because they said, he will not see our latter end. So looking at that last verse, why does Jeremiah think the doers of evil are doing those things? Look at the verse 6, the last part of it. Why does Jeremiah think the wicked are acting wickedly as they are? Look at your book, it says. Why were they doing this? Because they said, he will not see our latter end. Jeremiah believes they're acting this way because they don't believe God will do something. So what is Jeremiah wondering? Why God hasn't done something with this? Why do they prosper when they should be being judged? Now, be real honest in the depths of your heart. Have you had cause for any of that thought in watching events. Have you, with the people you know and the news you watch and the things you care about, have you had any sympathy for these concerns of Jeremiah? All right, look next, chapter 15. In verses 15 through 21, I sat alone. Were you ever in a situation as a kid or at any other time when you were the one who got isolated, left out? Well, in this situation here, Jeremiah is describing the things going on and how the people have not responded to his message. He feels like in verse 10 of chapter 15, "Woe is me, my mother, that you bore me, a man of strife and contention to the whole land." That's how he feels. I'm everybody's enemy. I'm always, the old song you hear, "I'm a man of constant sorrow." You ever hear that? There's not, in this case, he's a man of constant opposition because of the work God gave him to do. And this is a prayer starting at verse 15. "O Lord, you know, remember me and visit me and take vengeance for me on my persecutors." What's a persecutor? He does evil to you for a good reason or because you're doing the right thing. You can have disagreement and not be persecuted. You can be mistreated and not be persecuted. When you're treated wrongly because you're doing the right thing, that's persecution. All right, make fun of. Look at how that comes out here in this prayer. "In your forbearance, take me not away. Know that for your sake, I bear reproach." What is reproach? All right, it's name calling. It's insult. It's criticism. It's animosity. It's hatred. That kind of thing. And here's the reason: "Your words were found, and I ate them." That doesn't mean he ate a book. It means God sent him God put words in his mouth, and he said what God sent him, gave him to say. "And your words became to me a joy and the delight of my heart, for I am called by your name, O Lord God of hosts. I did not sit in the company of revelers," that would be the partying of the wicked, "nor did I rejoice. I sat alone, because your hand was upon me, for you had filled me with indignation at wrongdoing. Now, why is my pain unceasing, my wound incurable, refusing to be healed? Will you be to me a deceitful brook, like waters that fall?" What is a deceitful brook? All right, it looked like it was a stream from a spring, and then when you needed it, it just dried up. And all you were left with was cracked mud. A deceitful brook. Like you think in the desert of these guys who get so dehydrated, and you see the waves of heat rising from the sand, and they think they see a lake off out there, and the guy runs out. At least this on TV, this is how they do it. And run out there and fall in the water, and he's actually flat on his face in the dust or the sand. Will you be to me like a deceitful brook, like waters that fail? And then God answers Jeremiah. I'm with you here in this. I'll be with you in what I've sent you to do. I'll make you like a fortified wall of bronze. Look a little farther here. Don't be a terror to me. Now, I realize reading a lot of passages here, but take the time to get the flavor of what he's experiencing. In this passage, there's the contrast between the fate of those who trust in man, verse 5, and those who trust in the Lord, verse 7, and there's a recognition of how deceitful the heart of a human being is, verse 9. And then the prayer comes along, verse 14. Heal me, O Lord, and I shall be healed. Save me, and I shall be saved. For you are my praise. Behold, here are the ones who reproach him and his enemies. They say to me, where is the word of the Lord? Let it come. Now, if I say Jeremiah begins his work about 627 B.C., and then Jerusalem is not destroyed, the people carried away until 586 B.C., then that'd be, 40 years when he's preaching this and nothing happens. The people start saying, making fun of him, you've been telling us that for 4 decades and it's never happened yet. You are out of your mind, Jeremiah. You're lying. And that kind of thing. And what happens, they say, where's the word of the Lord? Let it come. And then Jeremiah pleads with God, verse 16. I've not run away from being your shepherd, that is his prophet, nor have I desired the day of sickness. I haven't excused myself. I haven't said, for health reasons, God, I'm going to have to drop out on you. He says, you know what came out of my lips. It was before your face. Now verse 17. Be not a terror to me. You're my refuge in the day of disaster. Let those be put to shame who persecute me, but let me not be put to shame. Let them be dismayed, but let me not be dismayed. Bring upon them the day of disaster. Destroy them with double destruction. That kind of makes us stand back and say, well, I don't know if this is the same attitude to people of God. This is the prayer of a person who cares. And then, let me read just one more before we go. All right, and I'll be leaving off the main one in chapter 20, even with this. This will kind of help to finish the loop, though, for us. In chapter 18, this is the passage where the potter's house is visited and God shows he has the right to start over from a marred vessel if he wants to. In verses 19 through 23, when they're plotting against Jeremiah, verse 18 says, let's go make a plot against him. Let's strike him with the tongue. Let's not pay attention to any of his words. And then here's his prayer, verse 19. Hear me, O Lord, and listen to the voice of my adversaries. In other words, listen to us both. Should good be repaid with evil? And the answer is, I don't think so. Yet they've dug a pit for my life. Remember how I stood before you to speak good for them, to turn away your wrath from them. You get the impression Jeremiah's prayers for them. He has prayed for them in some way. Therefore, deliver up their children to famine. Give them over to the power of the sword. Let their wives and their children become childish and widowed. May their men meet death by pestilence. Their youth be struck down by sword in the battle. May a cry be heard from their houses when you bring the plunderer suddenly upon them. For they've dug a pit to take me and laid snares for my feet. Yet you, O Lord, know all their plotting to kill me. Forgive not their iniquity, nor blot out their sin from your sight. Let them be overthrown before you. Deal with them in the time of your anger. That's the honest feelings of a man who cares about God's cause and is suffering because he's doing what God gave him to do. But you gotta, in order to handle this, I think, properly, you gotta remember that the covenant that God made with his people is what's being enforced here. A prophet, remember we said last week, a prophet, a king is the covenant representative. A prophet is the covenant enforcer. The terms of the covenant are being enforced. And you have to remember that what's at stake is God's inheritance, the inheritance of the Lord, his portion, the land, his people, was being given to idols, was being filled with abomination, was being spoiled. And Jeremiah and God cared about that. And if there's one thing that would stand out to me about this week, I'd go back to the model prayer. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done. Hallowed be your name. And your kingdom, that idea would be what would be at stake in this passage. I know reading a bunch of passages, it's hard to maybe to look into one, but put them all together and think of what it would have been like. Ruth. Yes. That's what chapter 20 is about. He was thrown in an old muddy cistern. He was struck in the face. He was put in the stocks that you mentioned, and he was threatened over and over again. Ridicule. His words got cut up by the king and thrown into the fire. That kind of thing. I want us to pray before we go tonight. Thank you again for being with us.